Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to another episode of the Self-Build Plus podcast, where we chat with self-builders, suppliers, and experts about all things home building and renovating in Ireland on both sides of the border. I'm Astrid Mattsson, your host and the editor of Self-Build magazine. This episode, we're joined by Richard Sloan of Sonus and Gwen Kenny of Divine Design to talk about how to tackle the bathroom in a new build or in a renovation project. Maybe start with kind of giving people an idea how the whole process of designing a bathroom goes. Like, usually, would it be the architect that would put that on your plans, or would you have kind of an interior designer involved? Would the bathroom supplier be involved at this very early stage, at the design stage? How are the first steps taken, would you say, Gwen?
It depends on the client. So sometimes the architect will design the plans and drop in just a standard layout of a bathroom into it, just to give the idea of what's going on. Other times the architect will get heavily involved and design everything and do out the correct final layouts. Sometimes the client will get an interior designer involved or an interior architect involved and they'll do it. Other times the client will do it themselves, and the final option is the client will give it to the builder to do, because they choose to work with him over somebody else. So it's really who they choose to work with to get the designs across the line.
And so what's the best method? Is there a best method?
Well, I would say if you're doing it yourself, do huge amounts of research so you end up getting it right. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the builder doing it, but generally some builders are heavily involved. Other builders, you know, just do what they've done a million times before. So it's quite generic and it might necessarily work for the family. And then where an architect or a designer, an interior architect, will actually really consider the layout, the use, the space, how it's actually going to really be used and give it the best from that.
Okay. And Richard, how would a bathroom kind of supplier be involved early on at this stage, or would you guys come in a bit later usually, or how would that work?
To follow on what Gwen has said, it's really depending on the client, and it's often a collaboration between architects, the client themselves, the builder, the installer, and somebody like Sonus. So we would have clients coming into the showroom here, for example, to look at product selection, and in some cases they've come in at a very early stage, you know, with a blank sheet really, and that's very helpful for us at that stage, because what we'll be doing, we'll be trying to stimulate them to think about high level ideas in terms of what they want. What's their aspiration from a look and feel point of view? I think it's important that you don't probably put all of your reliance into one particular stakeholder, because I think a supplier like Sonus will have a lot to contribute. Your architect or your interior designer would have lots to contribute as well. And even the builders, to be fair, from, you know, based on experience. And it depends on how close they are to product selection themselves. But everybody will have a view. And I suppose if you take on board the various stakeholders and the different elements that they can bring to it, because say, for example, when we talk to a client, you know, they they may have a design requirement or an aspiration, and we'll certainly give them advice and we'll focus on the product that will most closely match that. But we would really strongly encourage that they always go back then and liaise with the trades themselves, and particularly the installer of the bathroom, to make sure that the requirements, you know, are going to be in place from a force fix point of view, and that the on-site conditions will suit what they're hoping to achieve. So I don't see it as being a very linear process. I think sometimes you've got to start with the client's dream and aspiration, and then we're there to guide them around that piece from a product perspective. But you really do need to consult with the trade and installer stakeholders, because there's practicalities involved as well. And I think, Gwen, you'd agree that builders will pretty much do whatever you want them to do, but they like to know what they have to do, and they need to know the size and the dimension. So it's often it's a collaboration, and we've seen clients come into the showroom and sometimes leave with more questions than answers, because, you know, it's not something that, you know, a regular person will do that often. You know, you might design a house once in your life. You might refurb your bathroom every 10 to 20 years. So by the time we meet a client, you know, most people really don't know where to start, and they find it quite daunting. But they know what they like in terms of the aesthetics, and they might have an aspiration around a particular type of shower or a freestanding bath. So we're looking to try and get the kind of the baseline of things that they like and don't like, and then we try and build it from there.
So then in terms of the practical decisions that would have to be made, let's say you get your planning and you have kind of a rough idea of how the bathroom layout's going to be, but before you actually start building and get those construction drawings finalized, there are a few things that you do need to decide upon, not to be disappointed later on when you find out you can't actually install it because you didn't make provisions for it. Would there be kind of just a basic checklist of what people need to decide at this early stage?
Yeah, there would be, and I suppose very, very obvious ones to start with would be wall hung products. So we're seeing a growing trend in Sunnis for wall hung toilets, wall hung furniture. And, you know, the problem for some clients is they make decisions too late in the process and they haven't provided for the force fix requirements. So if you take a wall hung toilet, for example, the customer will just be really seeing what's on the wall, the finished tiled wall. But in behind that wall, there's a frame and there's plumbing and there's wastes and there's supply and there's all sorts of requirements in order to facilitate that. So our advice to self-build clients is very much high level decisions as early in the process as you can. It's not really important to pick the color or the depth of the unit or even the width, but if you want wall hung furniture, you need to make sure that the wall it's going to be positioned on has sufficient supports and grounds built into that wall. So it either needs to be a solid wall or it needs to have supports inside the wall to be able to take the weight. So it's things like that that you want to have those decisions clearly communicated early so that the trades can make those necessary provisions.
And how about wet rooms, kind of the Italian showers as some people call them, or, you know, just kind of that open area, does that need to be factored in early on, or can you just kind of make a last minute decision for that downstairs bathroom to have it turn into a wet room?
Yeah, well, if it's a downstairs bathroom, it's obviously going to be on a concrete floor, but you still need to communicate to the installers that gullies need to go in at first fix before tiling, etc. If there's going to be any underfloor heating going into the bathroom, then all that needs to be factored in. For a lot of clients who want that wet room look, and if it's in an upstairs bathroom, depending on the floor construction and the material, then tanking would be necessary, and that's a liquid membrane that will be painted all over the floors and up the walls, and that gives a waterproof seal before any wet room can be installed. So yeah, absolutely, that is something that you know, it's not a last minute decision that you can just rock up and expect it to be completed for. You have to prepare.
Yeah And then obviously the location of services, as I think was mentioned earlier, you need to know where your waste pipes are going and that kind of thing. How about the choice of tiles, Gwen? Do you have to choose your tiles that early on, or are we
not necessarily? But I would say to you, it's become very, very popular that people are putting niches in showers now, and niches over the baths, and that's something that you have to communicate.
Alcove, is it, or what is?
Correct. Yeah, and that's something you'd have to communicate very early on. As Richard mentioned, the builders will do anything you want, but coming in as most people do at the tiling stage and go, and I want a niche here, you're kind of cutting it a bit fine, if not too late, and it'll cost you an awful lot of money to do it. And something else to consider at the first phase would be provisions for universal design. So if you're putting in grab rails or seats in the shower or anything like that, you should put in grounds at first fix. Or similarly, you mightn't actually do it now, but you might add in hard spots so that those fixtures can be put in at a later stage, but the grounds are there for it. So that's another high level decision to be made early on.
Okay, and the niches then, it's, what is it, a stud wall that has to be built a certain way, or how are they constructed?
It can be, yes, it can be a stud. If it's a stud wall that's going in, they'll just leave a recess into the stud wall and they'll frame it out. If it's going into a block wall, similarly, they'll recess into it. And if you were building in maybe a toilet with a wall-hung toilet, you might do the same over the cistern. Sometimes it's nice to have some niches over there or put them in the bath. So that can be done at time of construction of the stud.
Okie dokes. And so then choosing things like, you know, tiles, the sanitary wares, all these kind of decision with the finishes, glass walls and all of that. Where's the big cost elements in all of that? Like what are the budget busters for, or can you just bust the budget on all of them, I suppose?
I suppose it's how long is a piece of string? And maybe the choice is, where do you want to bust the budget? You know, so do you want the top of the range, shower or bath or whatever it is, because you're going to use it every day, spend the money on a good shower door, you know, that has that lovely clunk when you close it because you're using it every day. Are you going to use the bath? You know, will maybe if you need to cut back on budget, is the bath somewhere you can cut back? It's the toilet. So, you know, you can get products in the Sonus range that go from, you know, very good value up to very good value, but much more expensive. And so it's where you want to stop along there, but they're all very high quality. So it's more about the looks and the little added extras that cost them more money.
And so in terms of kind of the costs, what's an average bathroom cost if you were to go, I suppose, the below, medium, high spec kind of thing? Or is that just, again, how long's a piece of string? But...
Well, I suppose, is there a bath? Is there a shower? You know, is there a bath and a shower? Is the, you know, the toilets, all the rest of it. But if you're going kind of less expensive, you'll see kind of packets that you can buy for between 5,000 and 7,000, middle of the road, 10 up. And I mean, I've had a client that's bought a bath that was 25,000.
Wow, so, made of gold, I hope.
No, almost. But you can go as high as you want if that's what you so wish to do, you know. But the other thing is then trade. So if it's a refurbishment, then you're bringing in, you know, you'll be taking tiles off the wall, you'll probably be replastering, you'll be tanking, as Richard said, you'll be retiling, you know, you'll have to put on new plasterboard. You know, there's a lot of kind of that, where if it's a new build, you're going to have the trades on site anyway. So that actually ends up costing you less sometimes with trades than a refurb would.
Yeah, because and refurbs takes a lot in terms of coordinating, making sure everyone's on site when you need them as well, I suppose, because yeah, that makes sense.
Absolutely. And now at the moment, it is next to impossible to get trades.
Okay.
It's really difficult at the moment, so trying to coordinate everybody can be quite difficult for people. So in one sense, they're almost better getting a company or a builder or one person responsible for coordinating everybody.
Okay, well, that's good to know. So Richard, then how are bathroom supplies paid for? How does it work in terms of paying? It's a chunk of change there that Gwen outlined.
Yeah, so I suppose if you take Sonus as an example, so we are the manufacturer and the supplier who, I suppose, sells the product through the retail network, and we've a network of over 400 customers across the island of Ireland. So when it comes to paying for the bathroom, we as a business are invoicing the shop, the retail outlet, but for the consumer or the client, they will be paying for the goods either directly themselves to the retail outlet, or in some cases they may have an agreement with their builder who will supply and fit the material on their behalf. I suppose from a retailer's perspective, I would imagine if somebody's, you know, coming in to order a bathroom, they would probably expect some form of a deposit, maybe 25 up to 50% of the value. And once the product and the material is supplied, they would be looking for the balance of payment before the goods are released. If somebody's building a house, I'm sure they may go to a local, you know, builder's providers or merchant and maybe set up an account. because the local merchant will be very interested in getting, you know, not just the bathrooms, but also all the timber, the slates, all the various construction materials. So in some cases, clients could potentially go and agree a credit account with a local merchant, and then they can just discharge the payment as per the agreement that they reach with the merchant. So it really depends. So Sunnis don't get involved in taking the money directly from the end user, but we do speak directly to them, because obviously they're the client, they're the specifier in many cases, and we want to help them through that product selection process. But effectively then we will route that sale through one of our retail customers.
So in terms of VAT, actually, isn't it cheaper? Would it be cheaper to buy the materials through the tradesman that can charge a lower VAT rate, as opposed to buying directly from the merchants or from the VAT?
Yeah, so the builder will pay for the goods, and he'll pay the VAT rate as 21% as it is currently. But when it comes to actually charging the client, there may be an opportunity then for the builder to supply and fit and charge VAT at 13.5%. So again, that's a conversation for the client to have with their builder. Gwen, you'd be probably familiar with that process as well.
Yes, a lot, absolutely. And it's exactly what you said. So if it's a supply and fit, it's invoiced in at 13.5, providing the goods cannot be removed from the house. So a good way of thinking about it is thinking of a doll's house, and if you shook it, what would fall out is 23%, and whatever doesn't is 13.5. It's like just a rule of thumb.
In terms of your practical design tips for ensuite, family bathrooms, different uses for the bathrooms, Gwen, do you have some tips for self-builders to consider?
Absolutely. I would strongly look at who the users are. So user experience for me is a huge big deal. So who's using it and what do they need? And if it's going to be your plan to do it in 10 or 15 or 20 years, how are those users going to change in that time? So everybody wants a bath if they've young babies, and then they might put in a smaller shower or put in a shower in the bath. And then within 2 or 3 years, they're upset about that because they have a tiny shower where they could have put in a bigger one. Sometimes you'll see, we're asking who's responsible for designing bathrooms. Sometimes you'll see really clever like dog leg walls where you can have a bigger shower in one room and the space from the other room might be a wardrobe that's built in, or it could actually be a shower on the other side. So it's really thinking about those things and how it's going to be used. For me, in my world anyway, the smallest shower tray I'd recommend is kind of, well, very smallest would be 1,000 by 900, but average, I would prefer to get clients at 1,200 by 900. And the amount of plans I see with clients coming with 900 by 900 shower trays, and if you get them into Sunnis and pop them into a shower that small, they aren't happy, but they don't realize it until it's too late. So really look at the size of the tray would be my big thing. And then we're all getting taller as well, and our measurements, our anthropologic measurements are based on the 1950s. So, you know, over those 70 years, they're now looking at newer measurements. But there are things like comfort height toilets that we offer now. And that's a really good thing to look at, and whether that's what you'd need as well. And then from a layout point of view, you know, if you're in there at, and you're using your to put on makeup or to shave, you know, maybe you want to demister behind the mirror. Like, really look at how you use the space at the moment in your existing house and what bothers you about it. You know, so if you're putting on makeup and it's not blended and you're walking out and you're going into a better lit space and all of a sudden you see things you didn't see, then you need to look at lighting. You know, if you've no storage, then you need to sort that. So really look at how you use the space at the moment and what would make it better.
And what's a comfort height toilet then?
So a comfort height toilet is something that has a higher base. So if you look at the height of a standard toilet, uh-huh, from the floor to the rim of the pan would measure approximately 400 millimeters or 40 centimeters. For a comfort height, it would be anything above that. So usually in the range of 450 mil or 45 centimeters. So you actually get, it's a taller product. So when you actually go to sit down on the pan, it's actually easier to get on and off. So you may have heard of, you know, Nana had a chair. You know, when you were younger and your Nana had a particular chair, yeah, and it wasn't one that was really hard hard to get up out of because it kind of had it was slightly positioned a taller chair to get it's up, easier yeah. to get in and get out. Yeah, so a comfort pan, if you can kind of think of it from that point mm-hmm. of view, would replicate that. It's probably come from, you know, Document M requirements for disabled use as well. So anyone that needed to access a disabled toilet, the pan has a taller height as well. So comfort height has now started to become a more common offering in domestic bathrooms, and you have the full range of designs available, whether they're fully shrouded, you know, the slim seats, all the different kind of nice aesthetics that you require, but with a higher height.
And Gwen mentioned the demisters, but Richard, what else is there in terms of these techie additions that can make your life easier in the bathroom?
Well, yeah, I suppose smart technology is probably the next wave for bathroom design. I suppose as the market that we operate in here is probably not as advanced maybe as some other countries, and I suppose Japan is probably one that springs to mind with significant, you know, smart technology built into toilets. There is a growing demand for that, and it's definitely something that Sonos is looking at for the future. Smart showers is another opportunity that we're currently exploring.
What is a smart shower apart from a smart shower?
Is something that it connects to an application on your phone, and you can have predetermined settings linked to your alarm. So when you wake up in the morning, your alarm goes off, it activates the shower, and it'll run up to temperature. You can have safety parameters built in there for the kids and stuff like that. But it's a product that's still in the development process.
That's a bit of a gimmick, isn't it? Can't you just turn on the shower and wait for a second for it to get to temperature?
Of course you can, but hey, come here. Everybody wants to be connected now to everything. So
yeah.
So Bluetooth devices in mirrors sometimes for some audio. Certainly, you know, the sensor switches on mirrors now with lights, you know, we don't even want to touch a button anymore. We just want to wave our hand to activate. So that's the sort of stuff that we'd be seeing popular.
And electric underfloor heating, that's one of the things I think people don't necessarily consider if they obviously we do put underfloor in throughout our house these days, but mostly in a refurb scenario. Is that something that has to be factored in earlier on, and what are kind of the costs involved and the steps involved? Gwen, do you? Yeah,
before tiling, it would have to be considered, and for electrical supplies in the first fix. But it is something that if you kind of thought of just before second fix, they could do for you. It's not very expensive, but it also just takes the chill out of the floor. So if generally it's a product, something similar to a Devi mat. And if you were using that solely to heat the space, you might end up a bit disappointed. So it's always good to check the BTUs, the British thermal units that are required by the size of your space. There's apps you can download on the phone now, and you fill in all the information and it'll tell you the BTUs that you need, and then I would generally add on 10% for good measure, and then ensure that you're getting that from either your heated towel rail and your Devi mat combined, or from a radiator.
And the heated towel rails, they don't always heat. That's right. I've noticed. So yeah, it's is there a minimum that should be looked out for that, or is it just a combined thing for the entire room? You just look at the overall, what you get.
Yeah, I think it's really important, Astrid, that people don't choose heated towel rails as a single source of heat in their bathroom, because they are for heating and warming towels. And it is a common mistake that people might make where, as part of a refurb, they might take out a radiator and put in a ladder rail, you know, with all the tubes, all the bars on it. But the actual BTU output, as Gwen has referred to, wouldn't be sufficient to match the needs of the room. So in our experience, you know, the heated towel warmers are a complement, and they're there to warm your towels, and they bring a nice fashion element, and there's a nice aesthetic to the bathroom, but they're not the single source of heat. So you really need to consult with your installer to make sure that those BTUs are being calculated correctly, and that the combined source of heat that you have, be it underfloor heating, radiators, towel warmers, that as a combination, you'll have sufficient heat output.
Okay, dokes. And so all of these things can kind of be added on, like even the Bluetooth speakers, or, you know, like stuff, or even a TV, let's say, that can be a bit of an afterthought. You don't really need to make that many provisions for it, apart from, because you'll have wiring going anyway, so...
Correct. You'd need to think of it from the wiring point of view. So if you were adding in a television or anything like that, or lighting as well is another thing you'd need to think of really at first fix, because they're going to put in wires. And if you want, like we have one client, you're talking about the showers coming on. We had one client and the LEDs changed the colour on the hour. So if they get up and walk into the bathroom, they know within an hour of what time it is, even though there's a clock on the mirror that tells them to.
Okay.
You would need to put in all the wires for that at first fix, or, you know, you're going to run into things that are going to become more costly and shouldn't be.
Okay. So because that brings us into the building regulations, because there are some basic requirements in terms of electrics and clearances and things like that. Can you run us through those, Gwen?
Yes, so you have Part M, which is the one that you're all familiar with, which is the minimum kind of sizes for wheelchair accessibility and universal accessibility. And that would be kind of usually under the remit of the architect or the interior architect or designer to make sure that they're compliant with that. And especially if it's a new build and it goes on the size of the property as well. So the other one then, as you mentioned, is electricity. So while it's not a building reg, it's an electric regulation, and that is, there's different zones in a bathroom, and each zone I would have really big problems with clients that are not Irish arguing that they want sockets in their bathrooms, and they cannot understand in their houses in Spain or America or wherever they are, they have sockets, they dry their hair, what's the problem? But anybody who's lived in Ireland knows we've no sockets in our bathrooms, but we also have zones where the IP ingression protection lighting can only be used in particular zones. So you have different IP ratings and you have to correlate them with the zones which are near to the splash or the water. And then you have Part F, which is ventilation as well. So there needs to be fans basically in every bathroom, even if there's a window. But then if you have a heat exchange system, that negates it. So again, there's something there that you need to consider at how you're going to heat the house and whether you're going to be taking the hot air out of the bathroom as part of that or not.
Okie dokes. And then in case, let's say we're building a house through direct labour, that the self-builders hiring all the tradesmen themselves, wishing them luck apparently in this current climate, trying to get trades on site. So what needs organising and what's the sequence of events for that?
That's a really good question, because it is a little bit of a dance. So, you know, you'll have the builder doing maybe block work. It depends how much they're chopping it up, if you like. So if you have somebody doing studding and you have somebody else doing the plasterboard, and then you might have a plasterer on top of that, you know, that's they're all the steps. First, initially, you'll also then have your plumbing putting in first fix, your electrician putting in first fix, and then you will be moving on to your tiling and then your second fix. So you really need to know absolutely every single thing. So I would always say start at the finish and then go back to the start. So know exactly what you want, have it all laid out, everything done, know exactly where everything is, and then divide up who's doing what.
And in terms of deliveries and storage and things like that, would there be, Richard, if you're ordering, let's say, from a bathroom supplier, can you specify exactly when you want it delivered, and can you delay delivery? Because they're big, bulky items. You don't really want them on site to get damaged by anyone. So is there flexibility there for self-builders?
Yes, of course. And I suppose one of the advantages that Sunnis presents is that we carry all of the material in stock. So we have 2,500 products in our catalogue, and they're all stored in our warehouse here in Dublin. And the client will call off, you know, first fix items, and then they'll call off second fix items. So we have the orders lined up, allocated against the retailer. And then we just wait for the client to tell us when they're ready. And we'll then deliver the products to the retailer, and then the retailer will send them on to site. So it's good practice not to have products sitting around on site, as you said yourself, where it can get damaged. But even though we carry the products in stock, you can imagine that at any one time there may be a cohort of product that's not available due to kind of, you know, sales demand and waiting on new deliveries. So it's always good to have these decisions made nice and early, have your products secured and allocated, so that you're not going to have any overruns or delays because of non-fulfillment of orders. But you certainly wouldn't call it off at once and leave it sitting around on site. So it's generally a first fix process, and then the trades will come back, maybe do the tiling, and then you will do second fix of bathroom equipment, and there may even be some third fix then around accessories and finishing touches.
So then it would be flexible enough in terms of saying, I ordered for you to deliver in November, I actually want you to deliver in March. It wouldn't be too big of a deal, because things do get delayed on self-builds, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And again, the products that we carry, you know, our brochure is updated on an annual basis. But even if we have an order in the system and the product is no longer going to be in the following year's brochure, we will still keep that product on hand. If something was to change, for example, and by the time the client came back and wanted a particular product, if it wasn't available, because the range is so broad, we would have invariably a variant of that product that we could offer. So we'll always find a solution for the client, no matter what happens.
And that's an issue with tiling. Do you guys do tiling as well, or no?
Sunnis Bathrooms only provide the bathroom equipment. Yeah. So I appreciate when it comes to tiling, yeah, there can be shading issues, yeah, and stuff like, yeah, that. So yeah, that's something that needs to be considered for sure.
Yeah. What provisions would you have to make? When would you order like 10% more for...
I would also look at cuts, Astrid. So if you have a wall, you know, that's 2.4 meters high and your tile is, say, 800 high, happy days. But if it's not, how are you going to cut it and where is it going to go? You know, so you might end up with, say, a cut at 700, and that 200 that's left over is waste. It's no good. So you need to kind of decide that, especially because of the shade variations and stuff. So I would always add somewhere between 10% and 15%, but if they're expensive tiles, I would work out the cuts and everything and ensure that I have enough tiles, and then I would still add 10%, because inevitably when the tiler is cutting it, if he's left that short, he's always going to crack the one he has, or somebody's going to drop something or whatever. So it's always better looking at it than for it. And then they can always tile in a leftover box into the bath, under the bath. So if there's ever a problem and they have to break out the bath, they always have the tiles there ready to fix it.
Okay. And in terms of thicknesses and other tips for tiles, there kind of, or there's some tiles that are harder to lay for tilers or as well, I think, isn't there? And there's different costs. If they're larger tiles, don't they charge more or something?
It depends on the tiler. Now, you can get tiles as large as 2.4 meters by 1.2 meters. So they're like absolutely astronomical. They're bigger than your arm span and, yeah, you know, they're huge, yeah, tiles. But they need to go in at first fix for obvious reasons. And then you'll get smaller ones that are kind of 1.2 by 600. But 10 years ago, they were highly unusual. Now they're kind of standard format. You know, they still do 300 by 600, but they're, you know, the tiles have got substantially bigger. What some tilers would charge more for as well is the porcelain tiles, because they're harder to cut than ceramic tiles, but they're also much more durable. And sometimes you see self-builders and other clients putting wall tiles on the floor, and that's a bit of a disaster. So just ensure that your tiles on the floor are suitable for a floor.
And vice versa, in terms of putting floor tiles on a wall, is that okay?
Yeah, doesn't really matter that much. Yeah. It's the other way around. But some of the floor tiles would have a high slip rating on them, so they'd be hard to keep. So if it was in a shower and you were kind of getting shampoo or conditioner or whatever on them, you might regret that decision as well.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Could I just add to that piece when it comes to selecting, say, shower doors, for example, and you mentioned, you know, different tiles with different thicknesses. Often a client, if they're trying to be, you know, really well prepared, they may select a shower tray of a particular size, and then they will order the shower door that's according to that size. But if they go and choose a very thick tile, for example, there's an adjustment range for all the shower enclosures if they're going between two walls, I'm talking about. So what's really important before you order a shower door from any supplier or any brand is the finished tile measurement. Okay, so when the shower tray goes in, the tiles will come down onto the tray, and therefore that automatically reduces the opening. Okay, so when you select your shower door from one range to another, even within the same brand, even within the Sunnis offering, different ranges have different openings and adjustments. This is for in the case of going between two walls. So often what happens is clients order doors, and then the plumber goes and opens it, and he goes to install it, and then they realize that it's actually too tight, it won't fit, and they need a different door. So always measure tile to tile finish measurements.
Okay, dokes. And any other tips like that, Richard, in terms of other kind of products or things that people have to be aware of?
Not really. That's just one that's quite pertinent to the tiles that you were speaking about. But other than that, no, I think, look, my advice to clients is always to echo what Gwen has said. Start off with what you want, work your way back, consult the relevant trades and stakeholders along the process. And once that planning has been executed well, you know, you mitigate against most of these issues. Proper planning will always be your friend. And, you know, things like, you know, first fixing. Another example maybe I might share with you is, say, freestanding baths are growing in popularity. And sometimes clients will choose a freestanding bath after all the floor tiling has been done. But at that stage, it's too late for the freestanding bath shower mixer, because that will be a first fix item, and that has an anchor that goes into the floor before tiling. So again, it all comes back to this piece about setting out early what your finished result almost needs to be, and then working your way back. And then, you know, between your installer, your designer, a supplier like Sunnis, we will guide you around what those various time points are as to when you need to have those decisions made.
And so how long does the process take for, let's talk about a refurb. If you want to do a bathroom makeover from like the design part and then the construction phase, how long would you be looking at?
Well, Gwen, you can answer on the design side, but in terms of actual execution, an average bathroom refurb, depending on how invasive it is, like sometimes it could be just a cosmetic update. In some cases, you're stripping all the way back and maybe moving wastes. I think a week as a minimum is a good guide to completing a bathroom refurbishment. And that would be taking the advice that Gwen has already shared around having somebody manage that project and managing all of the various trades, because you know, you don't just have a plumber, you'll have maybe a carpenter, there's an electrician, there's a tiler, you know, there's skips to be organized, there's rubbish to be taken away. So there's a lot of coordination involved in just doing one bathroom refit. So having one single point of contact that's responsible for managing that, I think is probably best advice. So from an implementation point of view of actually taking out the old bathroom, putting in the new one, you know, allow a minimum of a week. From a design point of view, well, hey, Gwen, you could be all your life dreaming about it and planning it. So it really depends on the client's requirements, I suppose.
Yeah, Gwen, in your experience, how long does it take to design, like to actually get to something that's a workable plan from just working on projects?
I suppose it's really about trying to kind of find out what the client wants at the start. So a good interview for maybe 2 hours, going through their needs and their tastes and things like that. And then if you're redesigning the plans, it's in layouts, it's probably a couple of hours work, and then choosing fixtures and tiles is probably another couple of hours work. And then if they want a 3D of the whole thing afterwards, you know, that's probably half a day, depending on the intricacies of it.
I suppose it depends how focused you are and how clear you are in your vision as well as the client.
So, absolutely. And like Pinterest can be an enemy, really, you know, because there's too much there, you know, that sometimes and people follow trends as well, and in bathrooms that can be a big mistake, because they become very untrendy very fast, you know. So if you want a trend driven bathroom, I'd highly recommend that you only tile half the walls, and whatever is on the other wall is your trendy inexpensive item that can be updated every couple of years.
Right, okay. I suppose you could use towels and things like that to try to go with the trends. Absolutely, and try to use stuff that's not as expensive as tiling.
At the moment, like, there's some tiles going up that look like USB board, you know, so they're OSB board. And so, yeah, I've seen them quite a bit in South Builders, and they're very trendy, but I guarantee you in 2 years' time, they're going to become very untrendy. And even though people think they'll love them forever, you know, if something becomes untrendy and starts to bother you, it'll really niggle at you. You know, so if you were to do that maybe on the other walls as a vinyl or something, at least you can pull it off when you get tired looking at it and change it for something else. So I'd highly recommend picking products and tiles that are, you know, have longevity in their designs.
And in terms of comparing the design process from a new build to a refurb, what are the differences or the key things that you have to consider?
I suppose it depends how much upset people are willing to have. So in my own house, I pulled out my stairs. I put a winders on the top of my new stairs, took the extra meter into my bathroom, and then got a bath and a shower. And I also moved all the wastes outside from the back of the house to the side of the house.
Right. But, that's commitment. You know, so
that's commitment, yes, but I did it. I probably did it about 10 or 12 years ago. It needs to be redone now. But I have loved that bathroom every single minute of every single day, and it makes me happy. So, you know, it was worth doing it. Where if you have somebody who doesn't want to do that, then it's a lot, you're tied a lot more to what you can do. Sometimes you can move wastes, other times you can't, you know, so they might not necessarily get the layout look. The other thing you can do as well, and that's in both new builds, and I see it a lot in new builds and in existing builds, is move the door. So if you move the entry door into the bathroom, sometimes you can actually pull a whole shower in the space where you've moved the door from, and it works a lot better. So sometimes I see people and they're obsessed, especially on new plans, by the layout they have. You know, there's no cost, there's no implications to them moving the door either to the left or the right as they're entering the bathroom, but it can, or the ensuite, but it can really make a good difference to the design and the layout.
So how long did it take to do up your own bathroom? Do you remember? What was
Probably about 2 weeks. And I was saying that's to Richard good, there yeah. recently, yeah, no, but I would have had it lined up, and I would do a lot. I don't do it anymore, but I would have done an awful lot of project management. So I would have had it like a military operation. You know, so-and-so was in on Monday, Tuesday, so-and-so else was in. And you know, you had, so it was all.
And you had a relationship with them. So they probably prioritize your build as well to a certain extent on their schedule.
Well, not really, but I would have been project managing so many jobs that they would move from one to the other after me. So it would have been just programmed in like another job. And if the truth be told, they probably did mine less attentively than they did anybody else's, because they're like, when we're stuck, we'll be back tomorrow, and they'd run off. But they still got it across the line. But I honestly would not project manage a job in the current situation if I got all the tea in China for doing it.
Right. Okay.
Because I cannot get trades. You just can't get them at the moment. And I know that sounds very negative, and I'm not a negative person, but that's the reality. I mean, I have so many guys ringing me every day looking for somebody for a trade to do something. Mm-hmm.
And is one of the risks when ownership of a problem, like if you're trying to manage people independently yourself, and if there's where maybe two trades will join and meet if there's an issue, and both guys maybe blaming it on the other guy, and then the client is maybe left in the middle sometimes. So having somebody with overall responsibility to support that process, I think is really good advice.
At the moment, that's really, really good advice. I've one client at the moment, and they want to put Amtico flooring in. So it's like a luxury vinyl product on the floor. They want to tile the walls and they want to refurb two bathrooms. And that was exactly what I was trying to do, because you could see it being a leaking issue, and who was going to take responsibility if leaks happened on the floor, because the join of the tiles and the floor. So eventually they got a contractor who's going to do the whole thing. So that's the only person I need to call.
Would you put a contract in place for such a small job?
There should always be a contract in place for everything. It doesn't have to be 10 pages of litigious documentation, but there should always be a contract in place to kind of keep everybody safe and sound.
Okay. And would there be a standard, or go ahead, Richard?
Yeah, there would be. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Absolutely. Look,
I think from my perspective, and as I said, we don't get involved in the direct installation of the product, but just I would be aware that there's all sorts of trades out there, and there's great guys and there's not so great guys. And I suppose for bathroom installation, you know, it's really important. Get somebody that has references. You know, look for, you know, previous clients' work that they've done, and they should be proud to show and tell, and maybe you can maybe even speak to previous clients, because, you know, there's been some horror stories of people spending good money on bathroom products and the execution piece has really let it down. So I would always suggest get a professional installer who specializes in bathroom refits, and, you know, and good plumbers that you can rely on, because they will need to survey the bathroom before they start, and that will identify any other potential issues that you may come across. You know, simple things like, you know, clients will specify a new shower and maybe go for it, you know, a shower that needs pressure, high pressure, to give them that power shower performance, but the on-site conditions might be that they have an old cylinder in the hot press and a cold water tank in the attic, which is effectively a gravity fed system, so that won't provide enough pressure to actually allow the shower to perform. If you do then put in a pump onto the shower, you may have to upgrade your cylinder, because the hot water capacity may not be big enough for the family to use a more powerful shower. So there's loads of potential risks, but with the right professional advice and preparation and doing a full survey, it can really help mitigate against that. So always really look for references from reputable tradespeople, and there's lots and lots of them. But it's really important that you get all of that lined up, and then really be clear about the work that they're doing, the cost that's involved. And, you know, I would strongly advise it's a price for a job as opposed to a rate for a day, because things can overrun from a time perspective and costs can mount.
Mm-hmm. And also be ready to pay them when they're due their payment as well. Keep a good relationship.
It's really important you do that. To be fair to any trade, you know, if they've to procure materials on your behalf, you know, they need payment on time, and agree a schedule in advance and stick to that. It's really, really important.
But yeah. would you really get a contract out of a plumber? Like, you wouldn't. But even if you hire a builder, then you can get a contract.
Correct. Like, a plumber is only going to come in and do your plumbing, your first fix and your second fix. He's going to give you a quotation, which technically is a contract. Once you pay a deposit, you're signing up to the contract, you know. But yeah, if it's a whole refurb, generally somebody's going to give you an itemized quote, dates on it, and they're going to get you to sign it and give you a deposit. You give them your deposit.
Okay. Right? Yeah. And then you can set out everything. Everyone can set out what's expected of each other at that stage.
Absolutely. And I would do that for every job, no matter what it is, because it's clear, it's simple, it's easy to understand. The client knows what's expected of them. You know, the builders know what's expected of them, and it's just easy.
So, Richard, in terms of finding a bathroom supplier, obviously Sona is perfect. No one needs to check them, but just in terms of, like, you know, shopping around and stuff, you'd be going to showrooms and all that. Is it a question of looking for the warranties, or what would you think are the tips there in terms of choosing a supplier?
Yeah, well, I suppose the client should probably consider their budget, and I suppose there's different suppliers, different brands that offer, you know, different things. Sonus, I suppose we cater for the mass market. So as Gwen mentioned earlier on, you know, the products range from entry level all the way up to really high mid-market. But there's a quality standard that we apply to all of the products, irrespective of the price. So to give clients reassurance, you know, all of the products that we sell have the necessary CE certification, declaration of performance. We provide full data sheets for the installer, so all of that reassurance is there. And from a warranty and after sales point of view, all our warranties are clearly and explicitly stated in our retail brochure that the client will use to select the product. And those warranties will vary from a minimum 2 years for something that might be considered a perishable item, like a roller or a hinge on a toilet seat, all the way up to a lifetime guarantee. So it just depends on the product, how long lasting those warranties would be. But we have a fully qualified after sales service team in place. So we have 4 plumbers who work in our business, 2 work in-house and 2 work on the road as service engineers. So they fully support not just the client, but the installer as well. If there's any issues along the installation process, we support the retailer. So we take a fairly macro view around this whole process. There's a number of stakeholders in the whole process, and we're there to support each and every one of those. So the client is a really important decision maker as to what product they want to pick, but we won't just, you know, think of them. We think of the installer as well, and you know, they have a job to do. So if there's any problems along the way, we're there to support with spare parts and after sales to try and make it as seamless as possible.
Right. Okay. And Gwen, just to go back on the plumbing element, in terms of moving, let's say where you have your toilet or your basin or whatever, or your shower or your bath, how difficult is that to do? Is that a kind of a major job? Or
I would always advise looking into it. You know, you'd be surprised how not difficult it is for some, quite a majority of bathrooms. These, I presume you're talking about in refurbishment.
Yeah. You'd hope a self-builder toilets will know what they're doing, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly. Downstairs toilets are the most difficult because generally the sewer pipes are cemented into the ground, and trying to change them can be quite problematic. But you could do things like maybe build it out a little bit so the room gets a little bit smaller, but all of a sudden you have a wall-hung toilet in there, you know. But main bathrooms, they're generally wooden floors, and they can be moved. Sometimes it might involve a bit of boxing, other times it's like what I did outside, where they're going to fill a hole in the back and move it around the side, or vice versa. But I know a client recently, and they had the design laid out for the bathroom, and then the builder came in and said they couldn't have it unless they had a little bit of boxing, which is about 500 mil wide by maybe 200 mil deep, and they told them it was going to look horrendous and not to do it. So the clients didn't, and they squashed their bath in between their shower and another wall. So now if they're sitting in their bath, their head is either against the shower or it's against the wall, so it's not very comfortable. And if the boxing had been done and tiled in, it would have been minimal and would hardly have been noticed, because the bath would have been able to be put at a 45 degree, which was the way it was supposed to be, and would have covered it. So sometimes it's a little bit of, oh, if I have the boxing, can I live with it, versus, you know, but I'm going to have all of this if I do. So it can be a trade-off sometimes.
Okay, very good. And is there any other tips, advice we haven't covered that you wanted to mention?
I'd say downstairs loos, go mad, have fun. You know, you could put loads of personality into them. You're only ever in them for a few minutes a day. And it can be a really lovely place to experiment with and do something a bit different. And then finally, I suppose lighting is always something really worth considering. So, you know, get nice, maybe IP rated spotlights that are tunable up and down the Kelvin scale. So you can have that kind of lovely candlelight, warm orange glow, or you can have the brilliant white for shaving or putting your makeup on.
And how about the infrared stuff, where when you open the door, the light comes on or stuff like that? Is that a bit, is that something people do, or is it one of those gimmicky things?
It is sometimes. It's sometimes they have them on like movement sensors, and other times they have them on sensors. So if it's nighttime at a particular time, it comes on. And we've had one client who's put them under the Sonos wall-hung vanity units, actually little strips of LED, and they come on in the evening. So it just gives a gentle glow for the kids if they're up in the middle of the night, that they're not turning on lights, and it's so inexpensive to run, you know. So it's probably horses for courses. And it's nice sometimes as well to add spotlights into those little niches too, especially if they're over a bath and things like that. It just gives them a nice little night light at night time.
I would say
give yourself plenty of time, you know, in terms of research. There's so much possible when it comes to bathrooms now, so don't be kind of restricted by what you've already had in the past. So, you know, we would always invite people to come to the showroom here and touch, feel, compare all the different product options. And we've got some really helpful advisors in the showroom, and they're really there just to guide you through the product selection process. And we actively encourage people to try before they buy. So you'll often come into our showroom and you'll see people sitting in the bath, and there's a lot of laughing and joking going on. But we genuinely encourage people to do that, because baths come in all different shapes and sizes, as do we. So get in, make sure it feels comfortable, that it fits your needs. And we'll have people standing inside the shower enclosures and waving their elbows left and right to make sure that it's of an optimum size. So give yourself plenty of time to do the research and come to our showroom and engage with the product and touch and feel and really test it out. And, you know, I suppose be brave and be ambitious. And my advice, you know, when people are starting out with a specification, go for everything that you want, and then you can always cut back if it doesn't come in within your budget. But don't limit yourself and start by looking at the individual component price for every item, because you just get too confused. Start off with, this is your vision, this is your aspiration, let's get it all down on paper, and then we can tweak it, and we can always, you know, kind of dial up the specification on one particular component that you really want to splurge on, and we can dial it back on others to reach an overall price point for the project.
Great stuff. And just in terms of showrooms, what's the COVID protocol now in the showrooms?
Yeah, so our showroom is open from Monday through till Saturday. We close at 1 p.m. on a Saturday. We do have a limitation of numbers. So when you arrive at the showroom, you'll be asked to sanitize. We will provide gloves and masks, and we limit the number of people in the showroom at any one time. It's quite a big space, so it's a 5,000 square foot showroom, but we do limit the space. And our advisors are all, you know, they have visors and they sit behind screens. But at the same time, you know, we don't require people to make an appointment, but we will limit access into the showroom if there's too many people there. So kind of Saturday sometimes can be a busy day, so you might find you're asked to wait in reception for a period of time. And then we encourage people to maybe make their way through the showroom at peak times, in a, maybe a little bit more quickly than they would normally have, you know, midweek mornings and stuff like that.
And are kids allowed?
Kids are allowed as long as they're supervised. So again, we request no more than two people from any one family. So if you need to come at a time and bring a child with you, yes, they are encouraged. If somebody has travelled a long distance and they have two children, of course we will let them in, but we don't encourage it, and they do need to be kept under strict supervision.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And online consultations are still doing those, because I remember when COVID first hit, you had kind of people in the showrooms doing online consultations.
And that's still available. So again, the ideal scenario is that a client can come to the showroom and physically visit the space. If they can't for whatever reason, and I suppose in response to COVID, we introduced the online consultation. So our advisors can spend time going through the product selection and design process with the client through Teams. And in some cases, they might take that call from Teams onto the phone, and they might actually go around the showroom and do live demonstrations and open and close the shower enclosure, or, you know, point the phone into the inside the drawer of the unit so people can see what exactly it looks like. So it's very just versatile in terms of how we've responded. So we can support the client in many different ways.
Yeah, and that's probably by appointment, I presume, if you're...
The online consultation would be facilitated with a pre-agreed time, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. Great stuff. Was there anything else, guys, that we haven't covered? Or
I suppose my one thing is just to go back to that user experience and to reiterate what Richard said about the freestanding bath. There was one client who had wanted a freestanding bath and wanted stones all around it, and they had two little babies, and I asked why, and they thought it was gorgeous, it was going to look amazing, they'd seen it in a magazine, and I said, you plan a bath in the babies? Yeah. Are you going to be on your knees on the stones? Yes.
Yeah.
They hadn't thought of it, you know. So really think, and obviously they didn't go with it then, but so really think how you use it, you know. Really, really figure out how you use each space. And like that in the bath, you know, are you going to be sitting back? Do you want to lie back? Go and try it and have a shower. And one of my favorite bugbears is we get these lovely big showers, and then traditionally plumbers would always put the shower head on the shorter end of the shower. So you then facing the shower to wash your hair are banging your elbows off the two narrower walls. Where if the shower is on the wider wall, then you can stand there and wash your hair with the elbows and either side. Now, it's a choice, but being able to make that choice at first fix and tell the plumber what you want, the plumber doesn't mind in the slightest, but it can make a huge difference to your overall use of everything.
Absolutely. Great stuff, guys. And Richard, was there anything else, or I think we covered?
Just the last word on that would be to just visit our website, so www.sunnisbathrooms.com. You can request a brochure. We can set up a request for an online consultation. You can see all of our products, and you can also find out where to buy as well nationwide. So
very good.
That would be my suggestion.
Of course. Thanks a million, guys. Really appreciate your time.
Astrid, thank you. Thanks very
Cheers.
Much.
Cheers.
That's it for this Self-Build Plus podcast episode. Tune in next time for more tips and advice from experts and self-builders alike. And make sure to explore everything Self-Build Plus has to offer. The Self-Build Plus journey guides you through the process of building and home improving. The Self-Build Plus forum allows you to share and learn from other self-builders. While the Self-Build Plus videos and our Self-Build Plus virtual events are packed with information and advice. With Self-Build, stop dreaming, start building.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.